Radio Prague News.
The Czech state will spend far less when it holds the EU presidency in 2022 than when it last did so in 2009. The competition authority is now dealing with the first case involving Huawei, since it was barred from state contracts. And members of the Realists have voted to dissolve the right-wing party. The Czech government is aiming to spend significantly less when it holds the EU presidency in 2022 than when it last did so in 2009, Iroslas.cz reported. A draft state budget that ministries had until Monday to comment on envisages expenditures of 1.2 billion crowns on hosting the six-month presidency. That's around a third the outlay a decade ago and is considerably less than other countries typically spend. Prime Minister Andrej Babiš says that he's seeking to make savings in the areas of investment costs and personnel. However, the Czech Ministry of Foreign Affairs could find that it has insufficient staff to handle the demands of hosting a large number of meetings, Iroslas said. The Office for the Protection of Competition is investigating the first case relating to a bar on the use of Huawei products in the state infrastructure. The news site Navlivny.cz reported on Tuesday. A spokesperson for the antitrust authority said it wouldn't comment. At the start of this year, the Ministry of Health banned the use of hardware, communications technology and software produced by Huawei and another Chinese firm, ZTE. This followed a warning from the National Cyber and Security Information Agency. It said the companies represented a threat and shouldn't have access to essential state infrastructure, including hospitals, transport and energy distribution. Huawei then took a complaint against the Ministry of Health to the Office for the Protection of Competition over the company's practical exclusion from a tender for integrated system for regional hygiene centres. The Czech Intelligence Services look set to acquire increased powers to handle records and information systems after the Senate Security Committee unanimously approved the change on Tuesday. The upper house is due to vote on the government security bill next week. The legislation foresees the intelligence agencies being given greater scope to secure concealed identities in information systems and to acquire and process digital photographs and identifiers of individuals held in a number of information systems. The agencies will also be allowed to create their own facial recognition system in order to better make use of information from the secret services of other states. Members of the Realists have decided to dissolve the right-wing political grouping. Their candidate in last year's presidential elections, Jiří Hynek, told the Czech press agency. A group of founders last month recommended the voluntary breakup of the party. The Realists were founded in 2016 by political scientist Petr Robejšek, with the stated aim of defending national interests, security and the family. The Conservative Party got only 0.7% of the vote in the last general elections, while Mr. Hynek received 1.23% in the first round of the 2018 presidential elections. And finally, a look at the weather. Wednesday should be sunny in the Czech Republic with daytime highs of up to 30 degrees Celsius. Temperatures are expected to remain at that level or higher until at least the middle of next week. My name is Ian Willoughby, and that is the end of the news. Hi there, this is Radio Prague with me, Ian Willoughby. Today, protection for Prague's John Lennon Wall after tourist agencies organised graffiti spraying on the landmark. A 3D-generated replica of a missing statue of Thomas Garrick Masaryk is to go on show. And we meet Alex Zucker, who's a leading US translator of Czech literature. All that's coming up in today's programme. Prague's John Lennon Wall is to become more actively protected. In response to a recent practice of tourist agencies that let visitors spray paint the surface, the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, which owns the famous site, has decided to press charges. A special meeting between representatives of Prague 1, the order, and local residents on Tuesday agreed to a new system of administering the wall. And Tom McEncrow has the story.
During the 1980s, a wall on a square near Prague's Kempe Park became a symbolic place where Czechs would anonymously write their grievances against the communist regime, often inspired by the philosophy of John Lennon. The area eventually became known as the Lennon Wall and has since become a popular tourist site. However, recently the wall has been repeatedly vandalised, according to the Sovereign Order of Malta, which owns the property. The order has now called for legal action. Its media representative, Hedvika Čepelová from AMI Communications, explains.
The Czech Malthusian Order made a criminal report because of the evidence there have been organised groups that damaged the property on Velkopřevorské náměstí on Kampa, including the Lennon Wall. And the organizers of these tours give free spray paints to tourists and probably don't tell them complete information about what's out or isn't on the venue.
The Chancellor of the Order, Johannes Lobkowitz, says that the magical atmosphere of the area is being destroyed by vandals who spray nonsense and vulgarities on the wall that have nothing to do with the old message of resistance to communism. The frequent spraying means that a large part of the most recent artistic repainting of the site, which was carried out in March this year, is already covered up. Furthermore, maintaining the wall is not cheap. The order is forced to repaint damaged parts every week and is investing around £500,000 into the reconstruction of the wall, as well as the installation of CCTV cameras in the area. The Prague 1 local authorities have also pledged to be more active. Their plans include a campaign that will seek to raise awareness among tourists that certain behaviour can be annoying to locals. On Tuesday, they met with representatives of the order and local residents to discuss a new concept strategy for protecting the wall. According to Ms. Čepelová, the meeting was successful, with the respective parties agreeing to be active in preventing illegal activity on the whole of Velkopřerovské square. She said other measures are also in progress.
The order is also negotiating with other authorities and other institutions in the way how to bring back the cultural content of the wall. So it's not only repressive but also positive.
The Lennon Wall is not the only iconic site in Prague to recently be covered with illegal graffiti. Last week, two German nationals were caught by the police while spray-painting the Charles Bridge. Aside from being expelled from the country for 5 years, they were also forced to pay a hefty fine.
That report was by Tom McEncrow. Countless statues of Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, the founding father of Czechoslovakia and the country's first president, were erected in town squares in the first two decades of the new democracy. Scores were torn down under the German occupation, melted down in Third Reich forges to make bullets and artillery shells. But the fate of a handful of others remains a mystery, and Brian Kennedy has more.
In the heart of the Moravian capital of Brno once stood a proud statue of Father Masaryk, the statesman and philosopher who in 1918 laid the founding stone of the new state. Unveiled in 1928, a year after Masaryk's re-election as head of state, the 3-meter-tall statue vanished, falling victim, most likely, to common thieves. That same year, on the 10th anniversary of Czechoslovakia's founding, the Brno exhibition grounds were also established, with Masaryk's statue and legacy enjoying pride of place at the inaugural event. Now the current trade fair management have set a goal of reinstalling a faithful replica of the bronze statue to be unveiled in time for October the 28th, Czechoslovak Independence Day. Miroslav Drapela is director of MCAE Systems, the 3D printing company recruited to scan a surviving model of the statue, which survived in the depository of the National Museum.
The process captures the shape in minute detail, but without making physical contact, so it cannot damage the model. Based on these data, we can create a full-size model using robotics. Then the modeling clay is applied to it. That was followed by another stage, which took place at an earlier trade fair in Brno, when we machine buff the model.
The faithful replica is due to be unveiled on October the 7th at the start of the International Engineering Fair, the leading such event in Central Europe, with more than 1,600 exhibitors and 80,000 visitors taking part each year. The fair's main theme is Industry 4.0 and the Digital Factory, in other words, the digitalization of production, which is one of the main directions of the innovation process. The Masaryk statue will thus serve as an example of the high-tech craft combined with traditional artistry, with the foundry piece delivered into the capable hands of sculptor Ladislav Jezbera.
The machine measures everything quite precisely, so that makes things a lot easier. My contribution is on the fine sculpting or finishing, aimed at getting even closer to the original statue.
After World War I, statues from the vanished Habsburg Empire also were melted down to be replaced by Czechoslovakia's new democratic heroes, Masaryk chief among them. These, in turn, were often melted down by the Nazis, or later by the communists. Rather than reinstall replicas, some Czech towns and groups have commissioned new ones, often raising the ire of traditionalists, for example, for depicting Masaryk in more modest lights, more as an educator than a statesman. The town of Litomyshl, rather than continuing the cycle, elected to leave in place a statue of a communist minister of culture who had supplanted Masaryk's likeness, but placed a plaque at the statue's base explaining the history behind it.
That report was by Brian Kennedy. Now, in the last part of our program today, Alex Zucker is one of the leading translators of Czech literature into English, and I spoke to him in New York. New York-based Alex Zucker is one of the most highly regarded translators of Czech literature into English and works regularly with leading writers such as Jachim Topol and Petra Hulová. When we spoke on a park bench in Manhattan in late September, the conversation took in Zucker's time in Prague in the early 1990s, his long relationships with authors, and his criteria for choosing projects. But first, he told me how he'd first started translating Czech literature via an interest in human rights.
I guess I first became aware of Czech really through literature, and I have to confess it was through the novels of Milan Kundera. But that did not lead me to want to translate. That led me to want to work on human rights, and I did a master's program here in New York at Columbia University in international affairs in the late 80s, which was intended to make me qualified to work in human rights. But that was, of course, still under communism. But what happened there was my Czech professor was Peter Kusi, who was Kundera's translator at the time, and so I got into translating thanks to him.
But specifically, what were you hoping to do in the human rights area?
The main group that was working on human rights in Czechoslovakia at that time was Helsinki Watch, the forerunner of today's Human Rights Watch. So they were doing research and writing reports, you know, so they were interviewing people in Czechoslovakia about what was going on and what they were doing and publicizing their cases. So I guess that's what I would have wanted to do, was do the research and the writing of reports and traveling and meeting with people to the extent possible, yeah.
Communism ended, of course. You moved to Prague for several years. I was reading that you worked for several media outlets. What are your strongest memories of those days, the Wild East early days?
Well, I worked 2 years for the English section of the foreign department at ČTK, the Czechoslovak news agency, as it was called at the time, or press agency, I guess, technically, translating Czech and Slovak wire reports into English. And I still remember that very strongly. And that was really my translating school. That was where I learned to translate, I would say, because we did so much rewriting of the news stories and editing, moving things around. And it was the really gave me 2 full years of working with people, Czechs, who were either bilingual or at least skilled enough in both Czech and English to be able to talk in depth about how to translate things, how far, you know, when you need to go farther away from the Czech, when do you can you stick closer to it. It was really great in that respect.
And apart from working at CTK in those days and other outlets, what was your kind of life experience of living in Prague in those days?
I would say in some ways those were the best years of my life, in the sense that I was in my mid-20s. You know, I had a job that gave me all the money I needed. And really, I had an incredible core group of friends, Czech friends, most of whom were connected in some way with the literary review Revolver Revi, Revolver Review, and then some of them at that point were also writing as journalists for the investigative weekly Respect. So that was kind of my anchor there. And the people, you know, those people are all spread in all sorts of different places now, but gave me an amazing entree into Czech culture, art and music, and I guess literature that I really wouldn't have had otherwise. And that was partly also thanks to the fact that some of them I had met in New York City here already in the spring of 1990 at a conference on Czech literature.
Would among those people have been Jakub Topol, who you later translated?
That's right. Yeah, he was one of them. And he was really, I mean, I think he still is like this. Although I know in some ways he's very reserved and shy. He also is a great connector of people, or at least was for a long time, was always interested in introducing people to other people, and was really great that way, yeah.
And what was your first major commission as a translator?
It depends what you mean by major.
Or significant commission.
You know, what I usually talk about, my first book-length literary translation, which was a long short story by Jakub Topol, that was initially published in Revolver Review, Výletka na drážní hale, a trip to the train station, I called it in English. That was published originally in Revolver Review in 93, then came out as a book in 95. So it was published as a bilingual edition in Czech and with my translation by Petrov and Brno, which was under Martin Reiner. So yeah, that was 95. And then I had my first book-length translation in the U.S. was for Northwestern University Press in 1999, a book called More Than One Life by Miloslava Holubova, which Peter Kusi asked me to do as a sort of favor to him because Holubova was a friend of his.
You've translated several books by Topol, also by Petra Hulova. What does it mean to a translator to work with one writer over several books and over several years?
Actually, for me, it's pretty moving to have these relationships with these authors. There's a lot of trust on the author's part that's involved in allowing somebody to translate a book of yours, even if you're the kind of person who knows English and reviews it very closely, like Patrik Ožednik, for instance, or even more so if you don't, obviously. I think part of the reason that I have these relationships is that I realized at a certain point that the authors who are known in English are the ones who've had multiple books published. And that really, for an author to be successful, that's the way it has to work. Just selling individual books. I mean, I have any number of authors or agents come to me and say, this is a great book. This book won a prize. Do you want to translate this book? And my answer is, no, I don't want to translate books. I want to translate authors, because that's how they break through.
I was surprised to read in an old interview with you that there are too few literary translators capable of translating Czech literature. Why is that?
Well, there aren't that many people who know Czech. I'm not sure which interview you're talking about or what I said exactly, but that's still true. I mean, I was thinking on the way over here to meet you what we would talk about, and I do feel like there's an awful lot of great books being written right now by Czechs and not enough translators to do the work. Although it's not in just about the number of translators, of course, it's about really finding the publishers. And that's the part where things get stuck, is finding publishers where the books fit in. It makes sense.
If you take on a writer or a book that you haven't worked on before, what are your criteria? What are you looking for? Because you must be turning down a lot of projects.
I guess the bottom line is I have to like something about a book to want to translate it. Although I have done books basically just for money, but even then, yeah, there has to be something about it I like. I mean, I just translated a book over the summer, not for publication, but for an author who self-published a book of horror stories. He contacted me through my website, and we negotiated about the price and the terms and all of that, and I did it for him. And I don't know if he'll find a publisher for it or not, but I did enjoy doing it. I mean, working in the genre required me to use some vocabulary and phraseology that I don't get to use otherwise, and kind of operating more in the realm of cliches as opposed to avoiding cliches is also challenging in a way. I mean, to be able to work with cliches, I mean, that's, you know, mastering genre. But more recently, I guess what I would say is I'm much more conscious. I mean, I feel torn in two different directions, I'll say. On the one hand, I would like to just translate anything that I like and I think is a good book. But on the other hand, I want to get paid. And I do have some ideas about about what's missing in Czech literature and English, which partly comes just from my own ideas, but partly from seeing what translations from other languages have that Czech is missing. And one of the things that I've been talking about in the last few years is the disparity between the number of women translated from Czech into English and men. And the disparity is there in every language, but the disparity is especially great in Czech literature. And so apart from whatever other criteria I have right now, I am very interested in specifically translating women to try to do my part to help correct that disparity.
A few years ago in Prague, I went to an event at which you went through various versions of your translations of the beginning of a book. I think it was possibly Markéta Lazarová, and you showed how you chose a different tone, essentially. When you're working on something like that, do you kind of weigh up the tone at the beginning and then kind of stick with it? Because at the speed that you seem to be going at, like really considering so many different versions, you would never get anything done if you didn't kind of, you know, decide on a tone and go with it.
Yeah. Well, I also didn't finish translating that book, partly because it was so difficult, but mainly because I discovered somebody else had already done a translation of it. Carlton Bulkin, it turns out, had already done a translation for Twisted Spoon Press. Well, in my experience, and I think other translators have said the same, the beginning of the book is the one that you end up redoing the most, because it's really impossible, even if you've read the book more than once, to get the tone right from the beginning. I mean, I guess I can imagine it happening, but usually, I mean, I'm always more comfortable with and have a clearer idea of what a book is supposed to sound like by the end than I am at the beginning. So the revisions I do in later drafts are always heavier on the opening of the book and the earlier chapters than the ones at the end.
Obviously, you have fantastic Czech, but who do you turn to if you get stuck on something, if you simply don't understand something? You're here in New York, who do you turn to?
I've got two informants, friends of mine, Ivana Husáková, who lives here in Queens, and Irena Kovářová, who lives here in Manhattan, and they're both longtime friends of mine, and I thank them in my acknowledgments always, and they are the two people I turn to most often when I have a question about the Czech.
And otherwise, how do you keep your Czech up when you're here?
So my spoken Czech has deteriorated, I would say. I mean, definitely pretty significantly living here and not getting back to Czech Republic as much as I'd like. But my written Czech has gotten much better because of all the emailing I do. One of the authors I translate was complimenting me not too long ago about how good my Czech is. It's all the email, yeah.
Last year in Prague, you appeared at an event at the Václav Havel Library that was entitled Our Man in New York. And I was wondering if you feel in a certain way that you represent Czech literature, because you really do a lot for it here.
I always have mixed feelings about that, Well, I guess I would say, you know, Czech literature is obviously a big interest of mine, but it's not my only interest. And it's not as though my entire life is devoted to Czech literature. I mean, I am not, for instance, I'm not a scholar, so I'm not like an academic who spends all of his time reading Czech literature, reading articles about Czech literature, reading Czech history, teaching it. So my life does not revolve around Czech literature in that sense. So I don't, for instance, know as much about Czech literature in a way as somebody like Jonathan Bolton, who's at Harvard, or Christopher Harwood, who's at Columbia, who teaches Czech there. I mean, these are both people who read more than I do. And I am sure have a greater knowledge of Czech literature, all the different styles, the history, the trends. I have a different kind of knowledge, obviously, that comes from working on the granular level. But I think it's also, but it's not a bad thing to have that responsibility, which is part of the reason why I think about what has been translated and what hasn't. But what I imagine Czech literature to be is, of course, not necessarily always the same as what Czechs imagine it to be. And I think that came up in my discussion with Joachim Topol last year when he asked me to say what is the main characteristic of Czech literature? And I think I said something which was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but something like the main characteristic of Czech literature is that it's written in Czech. By which I meant only that, you know, there are a lot of different trends and types of literature being written in Czech, and I think we don't have that. I mean, not that many of them have been represented so far in English, and we could have a much broader representation, and I'm in favor of that, yeah.
Alex Zucker, who I met in New York last September. And you'll find that and another 25 or so interviews that I did in the city on Radio Prague's website. But I'm afraid that's all we have time for in today's programme. Please send any comments you may have to english@radio.cz. And you'll also find us, of course, on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. But for now, from me, Ian Willoughby, and all of us here at Radio Prague, thank you very much for listening, folks, and speak to you soon.